This is Gloria Moraga's One-on-One, a show designed to improve face-to-face communication in the digital age.
In journalism, burying the lead means simply you missed the point of the story. Example, you write and write and write and down someplace in the middle of the story, or near the end, you say, oh, by the way, my subject was shot and killed. He's dead. Oh, and he's the president of the United States. I can only talk about this like this because it was 1963 when the president was assassinated, 56 years ago. This one-on-one episode is with Mal Hyman, college professor and author. His book is about how the media buried the lead following one of the worst murders in our history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's nonfiction, and it's about fake news, lies, cover-ups, laziness. The research on the book was made possible because of the JFK Act, which required the release of thousands of top-secret files on the assassination.
I've been a teacher for 42 years in the public schools, 5 years in a medium-security men's prison, and the last 32 years teaching sociology and political science at Coker College. I've done human rights work in 8 countries now and monitored some foreign elections, run a couple times for U.S. Congress. I'm interested in political assassinations because I came of age in 1968 in Los Angeles. We had riots in 100 cities. The country is divided over Vietnam. I could see the air that I was breathing, and Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy were assassinated that year. So as an undergraduate, I took a class on political assassinations. And as a teacher, I noticed that whenever I talk about political assassinations, all the students were listening. So I realized, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to do more reading on this to do it justice. And by the second year of teaching, I realized I could talk about this for a week. When I got to Coker College, they allowed me to teach a class on political assassinations. So I have stayed the course after 27 years, finally finished the book on media coverage of the assassination of John Kennedy.
What's the title of the book?
Burying the Lead, the Media and the Assassination of JFK.
Why did you decide to dedicate 30 years of your career doing the research necessary to write Burying the Lead?
It's a public execution of a popular president that was likely to get reelected. We never got to the bottom of it. It led directly to a loss of public confidence in government. What an irony. Kennedy was making government work more effectively, and after his assassination, people lost faith in the American government. Trust in government, November 1963, before Kennedy's assassination, was at about two-thirds. By 1967, it was down to 1 in 3. The media never did their job on this, and students would ask me heartfelt questions about why haven't we figured this out? This is so important. And their earnest questioning inspired me. So I tried to stay the course on things.
Where should we begin our one-on-one about burying the lead, the media, and the JFK assassination?
Well, that's why it's always easier to teach an 18-week class on this rather than doing the brief version. But anybody who sees the Zapruder film sees the president's head going backward and the blood and brains hitting the motorcycle cop behind the president, which would indicate a shot from the front, not necessarily all the 3 shots from the rear. And as you read through the Warren report, which was set up by President Johnson to look into the assassination of President Kennedy, you read that 21 law enforcement officers thought the shots came from the front. You have 51 witnesses that said the same thing. That was enough to get me started. I didn't know if there were 3 shots fired, 4, 5. It looked like at least 1 came from the front. And you can get lost in the forensic evidence on this, but I stopped at the point where I figured that at least 1 shot came from the front, which would mean 2 shooters, which would mean a conspiracy, which was not what the Warren report came up with. And as you go through the Warren Report, 888 pages of legalese, you realize that it doesn't match the 26 volumes of hearings and exhibit that it supposedly is based upon. Yet as soon as the Warren Report was released prior to the election in 1964, it was greeted by the media with widespread acclaim that they had the bottom line, and if you didn't agree with this, you were a fool or you weren't patriotic. On the very day that the Warren Report was released, CBS had a two-hour piece, as they said, illustrating the Warren Report. This is as it is released before the 26 volumes of hearings and exhibit that the Warren Report is based upon was even released. It was also greeted by the New York Times and the Washington Post as being a report in archaeological detail and a remarkable effort looking at what had happened. And you could see early on that they were supporting the Warren Report, whether it comported with the truth or not. You know, if we turn the clock back a little bit further, the Zapruder film, which was taken by an amateur photographer in Dealey Plaza, that most people know from the movie JFK, was purchased by Time Life. But Time Life never printed all of the frames in the Zapruder film. They misdescribed what was in the Zapruder film to make it appear that the president was shot from behind. And one has to account for why, if they spent $150,000, which was real money back then, they wouldn't print all of the frames and they wouldn't describe what's actually there in the Zapruder film. Years later, people looked into the connections between Time Life and its editor, C.D. Jackson, and the CIA. C.D. Jackson had worked with the CIA during the Cold War at the highest level on propaganda operations. Well, as soon as I started to put this together, I realized there's more to this story than we're hearing.
Let's go back a little bit. How did CBS produce a two-hour documentary on the day the Warren Commission report was released? Technically and editorially, that would be difficult without having prior access to the findings.
You're right. And it was a red flag to me. And I got to this information after grad school in political science. So I was willing to, and I'd met people who had worked at the highest levels in the CIA, and then started to realize CBS cooperated with the CIA during the Cold War. They'd cooperated during World War II with a precursor to the CIA, the OSS, and they saw this as their patriotic obligation during a Cold War with communism that was anti-God and anti-freedom. And that alliance was actually quite strong. They cooperated with the CIA on a number of operations. They weren't the only mass media outlet that did that. NBC did. Reader's Digest did. There were a number of them that cooperated with the CIA. And this information came out in Carl Bernstein's piece in The Rolling Stone in 1977. And some of this information came out in Senator Church's investigation of the CIA in 1976. The CIA had, at that time during the Cold War, between 400 and 600 assets in the media that worked with them. There was a spectrum of relationships. Some, it was just people that were debriefed after going to Eastern Europe to do some reporting, and they'd talk over dinner with the CIA. Others put out pieces that the CIA had written. So it was a range of relationships. And according to Senator Church, between 400 and 600 media assets worked with the CIA during that time. I also talked with one of the Senate staffers that worked on that committee. His name is Locke Johnson. He's a professor of political science, University of Georgia. And this is 28 years ago, I asked him, well, I read through the report that said 400 to 600 reporters had a relationship with the CIA of one sort or another. And he looked at me and said, at least that many. So I think those relationships, now this is circumstantial, of course, could well have been put in operation. And you're wondering why. If it wasn't Oswald alone, what was going on here? Because we have this strange guy, Oswald, that it's all blamed on. And it all gets blamed on him very clearly after Jack Ruby kills Oswald. Then the FBI and the deputy director of the Justice Department, Nicholas Katzenbach, put out a memo to say the public must be convinced that Oswald is the lone assassin and he did not have Confederates. This was sent out to the mass media from the FBI and from the Justice Department. And this is before the investigation has gotten underway. And you see reporting at that point from mainstream sources and then focusing on Oswald as the sole assassin. And again, this is circumstantial, but we can see that change of reporting on it.
Wouldn't the fact that the government is pushing the Oswald is the lone gunman story a red flag? Why didn't some hotshot journalist go after the real story?
We have reports from some reporters that FBI people had visited them and made calls to steer away from certain aspects of the assassination and their coverage. We have a reporter named Connie Kritzenberg, who was from the Dallas Morning News, who was actually in Dealey Plaza at the time. And when she wrote up her piece, the FBI visited the Dallas Morning News. So we have some very heavy-handed pressures, presumably on the grounds of national security. Now, let me put the best case on this for why there might have been such government involvement and such a push to blame this on Oswald. We're about a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. There is a fear that we could go to war with the Soviet Union. Oswald is passing out during his life Fair Play for Cuba Literature. He's passing it out of an office that was run by a former FBI guy named Guy Bannister. Now, at this point, everybody wants to slow up and it gets kind of confusing. But Oswald had worked in the Marines, had a military intelligence card when they arrested him. Oswald had defected to the Soviet Union, lived there, married a Soviet woman, comes back into the United States, and he's meeting with FBI and CIA people in the United States. No one really knows who he's working for or what's going on. Day after the assassination, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, is talking to President Lyndon Johnson. And Hoover is saying, you know, when Oswald visited Mexico City to try to go to the Cuban and Russian embassies to defect again, the pictures aren't of someone who is Oswald, and the voice is not Oswald's voice on the phone conversations. Now, who is impersonating Oswald in Mexico City to supposedly be visiting the Cuban and Russian embassies? The source of the information is the CIA in Mexico City, which might have been setting up a legend or a false story to say that this was Oswald. And if he did it alone, or he was part of a plot, that he was doing it with the Cubans or the Russians, and we need to shut this down or it will lead to World War III. That was actually what was told to Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, that initially did not want to head a presidential commission so named after him, the Warren Commission. He didn't want to do it. And we know from the conversations of their phone talks that Johnson said to put on your uniform and serve your country and head this commission, to which Earl Warren did. And they came up with Oswald did it alone, and he had no connections to other countries. He was basically a lone nut.
Chief Justice Earl Warren, who was the chair of the Warren Commission. And the question is always, why would Chief Justice Earl Warren lie or cover up information about the assassination of our president?
Sure, he was a progressive Republican, former governor from California, who took on a number of tough cases in the Supreme Court. What most don't know, if you don't have time to read this, and I get the blessing of being able to read this material, is he wasn't there for many of the sessions. In fact, there's only one session with all of the Warren commissioners together. Basically, staffers did this. And at the end, Warren knew that it was a divided group that wasn't convinced that it was Oswald alone, or there was just three shots fired. So, yeah, I think Warren was a respected figure, and he knew this had intelligence implications. One thing that your viewers may not realize is the former head of the CIA, Alan Dulles, who was fired by Kennedy after the failed Bay of Pigs invasion, was actually appointed by Johnson to serve on the Warren Commission. He was its most active member and covered up many things, not surprisingly. You also had sitting on the Warren Commission a guy named John McCloy, who had also worked with the CIA at the highest level and had headed the World Bank. Well, these people weren't necessarily finding the bottom line of who killed Kennedy. They might have been working for a cover story. That was one of my operative assumptions as I started looking into this. It was only from declassified documents last year that we found out that of the three people fired after the Bay of Pigs, Alan Dulles, who had headed the CIA, unprecedented that the head of the CIA gets fired by a president, and his top assistant, General Bissell, and General Cabell. General Cabell's brother was the mayor of Dallas in 1963, and Earl Cabell also was working with the CIA as an asset. That was finally released from some of the documents that were released last year. Now, the JFK Act, after the movie JFK, set up a commission that was supposed to declassify all of the documents except for some that would protect sources and methods from now 55 years ago, which couldn't really amount to too much. But we have thousands of documents that are still classified. One of the ones that was released was about Earl Cabell as a CIA asset and the Cabell's family. Their dad had been the police chief in Dallas. And as you start to look at what happened on the ground in Dallas, there are a lot of things that don't lead us to answers that are very convincing about the role of the police, about the role of the sheriffs that were told to not work in Dealey Plaza, the role of military intelligence that was told not to work in Dealey Plaza, the role of the Secret Service that set up a parade route through Dealey Plaza that had a hairpin turn that is explicitly prohibited by the Secret Service manual. All of this was done. The Secret Service didn't check the roofs. They didn't check the windows on the parade route. Their agents were drinking till 4 o'clock the night before. All of this is strictly prohibited by the Secret Service. There's what's called security stripping, so that you allow whoever is in place to make the hit. Well, of course, this sounds appalling at first until you start to work your way through all of the things that the Secret Service didn't do, from the motorcycle police that were supposed to be on the side of the president to protect him, to more closely protect the parade route, to slowing down the presidential limousine to 11 miles an hour. All of this is strictly prohibited by the Secret Service. It was only years later that I started to look at, well, who headed the Secret Service? A guy named C. Douglas Dillon, who had worked with Alan Dulles in the CIA and had worked with John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State at the time. The Dulles brothers, one headed the CIA, one headed the State Department during the 1950s, during the Eisenhower administration. C. Douglas Dillon was a close personal friend and had actually worked with him since the OSS time during World War II. Who was the acting head of the Treasury Department that took over the responsibilities with the Secret Service? A guy named Gaspar D'Angelo Bailyn. Well, Bailyn also was friends with Alan Dulles. Now, that doesn't prove that those actions of the Secret Service that have been condemned in every investigation that we've had of the Secret Service and what they didn't do properly during the presidential motorcade in Dealey Plaza, it doesn't mean that the CIA set it in motion, but those connections are there. And that's why it's important, after we win the Cold War, for the American public not to be treated like children, so that we get the files released, so we find out our history. This is the role of the media. The media is the fourth estate. They're supposed to be the lifeblood of democracy. If they're asking these questions, the public that is asking these questions. And when they ask these questions about who killed John Kennedy, they'll ask those questions about who killed Martin Luther King.
King, because the same type of security stripping is in place. The same type of cover-up is in place, and America will get our history. John Kennedy said to Eastern Europe with Radio Liberty in 1962, in order to inspire those people to overthrow communism, he said, "We seek a free flow of information. In a nation that is afraid to judge truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that's afraid of its people." And I'm afraid it was prophetic, and it's as valid today in the United States as it was to Eastern Europe back in 1962.
Bottom line, who was responsible for the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy?
We need to have the release of the rest of the files in order to really know. But there's a fact pattern that shows cover-up on the part of many agencies, whether it's the FBI or the CIA, military intelligence. We know the mafia was probably involved at a lower level. And the business groups that work with the CIA and had for decades now get called into question. Oil companies benefited from this. The bottom line is there are many connections between the CIA and the mafia. The attempts to kill Castro were efforts in 1961 and 62, but also the CIA worked with large transnational corporations, banks, and oil companies. Were they the connections through Allen Dulles? Bottom line is, we don't know. The rest of the thousands of pages of documents that have been classified, if they're released, will get us closer to knowing what's going on. There are a lot of groups that benefited immediately when Johnson took over the presidency. Efforts to cut the depletion allowance for oil no longer were there. Efforts to rein in the CIA stopped. Efforts to change, perhaps the head of the FBI, ended. Prosecutions of the mafia dropped off about 80%. The comprehensive test ban treaty that Kennedy was pushing for was ended by Johnson. The funding for the Alliance for Progress all throughout Latin America was gutted after Kennedy's assassination. The efforts that Kennedy was bringing about to pull us out of Vietnam completely changed, and Johnson brought us into Vietnam. Policies toward Cuba, policies towards Indonesia changed. So circumstantially, there are a lot of groups that gained in power once Kennedy was assassinated. And Kennedy was likely to get reelected, and his brother Robert was likely to have a great shot at the presidency as well. So all of that changed, which leads us to questions of motive. But the truth is, we really don't know. We need the rest of the files to be released to have a better idea on this, and it should lead to another investigation.
Why haven't all the files been released?
The JFK Act that was set in place after a million people in the public wrote letters after the movie JFK saying, "Release the files." That act has not been followed, and the press has not done their jobs showing the public that the act has not been followed to declassify those documents. So the grounds that are used, I think, are rationale, national security, but 55 years later, that's hardly compelling.
Okay, we don't know who killed Kennedy, but clues in the documents point to a cover-up by the CIA, the Secret Service, organized crime.
Yeah, we have the ties with Jack Ruby and the mafia that seem pretty clear. Oswald met with a number of people that had CIA connections, both in Dallas and New Orleans. He met with people that had FBI connections. I mean, Oswald got arrested once in New Orleans, and an FBI agent comes into the cell to talk to him afterward. He's had a little scuffle in New Orleans, and an FBI agent named Quigley is talking to him, but Quigley destroyed his files, so we don't know exactly what was said. We've got Oswald, who was trained by military intelligence to speak Russian at the height of the Cold War, defects to Russia. When he comes back, he's meeting with all sorts of people of connections to the oil business in Dallas that are retired military, retired CIA or CIA assets. The nature of those connections, we still don't exactly know. So there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle that we have in place, but it is tough to get a clear picture on it. Even years later, files are destroyed by military intelligence. The Office of Naval Intelligence, when asked by the Assassination Record and Review Board in the 1990s to come up with their files somehow didn't cooperate. And we know from lieutenant colonels that were tasked to cooperate with the Assassination Record and Review Board, Terry Pike, that she was taken off the case when she was starting to release some of the military intelligence files. So this one is more widespread than most folks might imagine, and we still need to have the classified files released so that we can put together a clearer picture on things.
So we don't know who was responsible for the assassination. What we do know is that the media dropped the ball and buried not only the lead, but the entire story.
Absolutely. And I think at first they didn't follow this the way they might have because they were instructed by the FBI and the Justice Department, probably on the rationale of national security, that it was best to go along, that the government had figured out what had happened. This close cooperation between the media and the government that had started with World War II, I think was still there during the height of the Cold War. And that's why they felt obliged to not ask the questions that were being asked in the European newspapers during that time. And Europeans were far more open to the idea there could be a political assassination of a leader. We were not seeing that in the press. And essentially, it was the public that was asking the toughest questions. And the alternative media, magazines like The Nation or The New Republic, that were raising the questions. And it took a while for the public to read through the Warren Report, 888 pages in the 26 volumes of hearings and exhibits, to recognize both the contradictions and what was left out. So you had a critique of the government report. And as that started to percolate through the public and through the alternative media, the mainstream media did start covering this by 65 and 66, which helped lead Jim Garrison to ask a more critical set of questions starting in 1967. Now, Garrison got no cooperation from law enforcement, from the CIA, from the FBI, from IRS, from other district attorneys. And he was penetrated, just to give you an idea of the games that were played on grounds of national security. Jack Anderson, a leading columnist at the time, also was a hostile liaison to the FBI. Anderson interviewed Jim Garrison for 4 hours and reported back to the FBI what Garrison was doing. Garrison was hit by a number of major mass media sources to discredit him, even though he was onto the case that I was talking about, the contradictions in evidence and the cover-up and the connections with Oswald and Ruby. Garrison was starting to uncover that. There was a four-hour piece by CBS that hammered Garrison. There was a piece by NBC in 1967, a white paper that hammered Garrison to make it look like he was a strange figure, that he was reaching for the truth, that it wasn't grounded in facts, that he was just self-aggrandizing. And we now know in retrospect that those pieces were meant to hurt Garrison and make the critics seem less legitimate.
Why would the mass media cover up this story? After reading your book, it's mind-boggling.
I'm not certain, but if I'm to hunch on it, I think at first there was this close cooperation, so they weren't asking the forensic questions, the contradictions and evidence in Dealey Plaza. I think that would count for the early cover-up. The media was not allowed into the Warren Commission, so they waited until the report was released. There were a number of leaks of the report to the New York Times, to CBS, that we know of. And then the report was greeted as if it was the whole story on things, and that you were foolish or unpatriotic if you questioned it. So that would account for early lack of coverage. Mainstream media did some good coverage, but it took a while before they were writing about these things a number of years later. When Jim Garrison got into looking at the case, he really took the lead for all of the critics. And his investigation was hurt by the mainstream media, I think in part because some might have realized where this might be leading. Again, at the height of the Cold War, where the country is starting to have problems with riots in the cities. I think there were hundreds of reporters that wanted to do the story. They were called off by senior management because management had cooperated with the CIA, with government officials. It was still the Cold War. There was Cuban Missile Crisis just a year before. So there was a sense that if national security issues were in play on this, and there might have been connections, we wanted to avoid World War III. Nobody knew Oswald's connections. So I think at first there was a sense of cooperation to maybe calm the public because goodness knows where this really would go. After the Warren Report was released, it gave the appearance of being an exhaustive report and was seen as such by major mass media outlets, with a sprinkling of questioning from the alternative media that actually had been there all along. And the media again was not allowed to be part of the Warren Commission hearings process. Down, right? So it took a while before even those who were well-meaning in the mainstream media and the alternative media and the public to ask a better set of questions. And those questions started to cohere so that another narrative was out there about the forensic evidence, and some reporters were writing on it. And I think Dorothy Kilgallen is the most famous, the leading columnist of the day, who had her TV show, who was breaking new material on Jack Ruby and his ties to the mob. All of a sudden, at the peak of her career, supposedly commits suicide at the age of 52. She was the lead reporter from the mainstream media that was breaking the story. And a number of people have written books saying there was foul play. And I think there might well have been. She was the reporter that was breaking the story the most by 1965. So fast forward to 1967, the Jim Garrison investigation. Garrison's asking a tough set of questions about government involvement and the mafia at a lower level cooperating with the government. And Garrison is not getting cooperation from government agencies. And he is hammered by the mainstream media. I think a case might have been made that Garrison was self-aggrandizing, that he didn't have his facts straight, and the country was deeply divided on the grounds of the Vietnam War. We had had race riots in dozens of cities, and maybe the thinking on the part of the establishment was, if the public finds out that the government might have been involved in the assassination of the president, God knows what's going to happen in the middle of the streets. That might have been the rationale. I'm speculating. But we can look and see at the terrible job done by CBS and NBC that were basically hatchet jobs on Jim Garrison's investigation. And with the benefit of hindsight, we can go back and look at what they did. And Eric Severide ended the four-hour CBS special looking at a reinvestigation of the Warren Report. And he essentially said, if you don't believe the report, you're an idiot. Well, this delegitimized the critics and I think was the media for some reason not honoring the questions the critics were raising about the execution of the chief executive of the United States. Bottom line, as we've alluded to, free press is essential to democracy. It's the lifeblood of our democracy. And if I'm to share from James Madison, popular government without popular means of acquiring information is but a prologue to a tragedy, a farce, or both. Poor reporting over decades have left America with more problems economically, environmentally, geopolitically, so that as we don't solve our problems because we have had a lack of information, it sets the context for a demagogue to get elected.
And then, dear listener, our one-on-one turn to the current president and fake news.
Well, it's ironic that an authoritarian president like Trump uses the term fake news to delegitimize his enemy, just as Joseph Goebbels did to opposition in Germany, to call the press the enemy of the people. And then we have Fox News that cooperates with this administration. Fox really isn't reporting. They are a propaganda arm set up by Roger Ailes, who worked for Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and actually for Nixon before that. And it was avowedly conservative Republican, but also supporter of Trump. So that what comes out of there is more propaganda, the news, and it's pretty sophisticated for the American public. We didn't have anything like that during the time when John Kennedy was assassinated, or even in the 1960s. We also have a corporate-owned mass media that has never really covered issues of labor, working people, minimum wage, corporate pollution the way they needed to, because it was corporate-owned. So we've had news that was fake when it came to the rights of workers and the environment all along. Fox Network, which is avowedly pro-Trump, other than a few mild dissenting voices, and has kept the president's approval rating up in the high 30s, which has left Republican elected officials afraid of taking him on. And the hammering away at the mainstream media has left them more cautious in criticizing President Trump, because they know they're going to be hit not only with Fox and Twitter, but with the propaganda efforts of the presidency. And it's left a weaker mainstream media as a balancing force in trying to create truth for the American public in our marketplace of ideas.
And of course, there's the digital revolution.
The digital revolution, as we know, is cut into newspapers, radio, and TV markedly, which means there's less trained reporters out there to cover these stories. And they all take note of where the rewards are and where the potential punishment is if you say something or write something critical about this administration. There's going to be significant and nasty pushback. And there is an authoritarian regimes, and we seem to be drifting that direction. So you're right, the digital revolution is a critical factor. There are just less trained reporters out there trying to do the investigative reporting.
So President Trump did not allow the release of all the files in 2017, citing national security again. But he ordered their release in October 2021. I'll see you then. I'm Gloria Moraga, one-on-one with Mal Hyman, author of Burying the Lead, The Media and the JFK Assassination. The book is available on Amazon.